You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Brevet. Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Gravey. I'm your host today. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a world without GMOs, a thriving world where our food is safe for our children and our grandchildren. If you share this vision, go to our website and join us. Our show today is brought to you by Biolumina Spirulina, one of the finest whole food products in the world. Hi, it's Carol again. I don't endorse many products, but Biolumina Spirulina is one product that I use and I highly endorse. Spirulina is called a superfood because of its high nutrient content. It has been proven that you could actually live on this product. Biolumina is the premium spirulina. It contains a high level of phycocyanidin and is a powerful antioxidant. There's also a lot of evidence that spirulina is a radiation protectant and cleanser. To find out more about Biolumina, go to newphoenixrising.com/beingwell or click on the link on the show page. I think you're really going to love this product. Today on the show, we will be talking to Paul Fry of Fry Vineyards. Fry Vineyards was the first American organic winery and the first maker of certified biodynamic wines in the U.S. Paul is their winemaker and has been working with this family-owned business for nearly 30 years. There are 12 children and spouses that have worked for the business, and we will be talking with Paul today about organic wines, biodynamic farming, GMO yeast, and what effects that nuclear power plants can have on agriculture. Paul, welcome to Food Integrity Now.
Thank you, and we're glad to be here.
I'm interested in hearing what you have to say today about organic wine and biodynamic wine. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you today is that I personally love wine and I eat very healthy. And many people may not think about their wine containing chemicals or possibly GMOs, but many wines do contain these ingredients. And I think most people know about sulfites, but that is one thing that is labeled on wine bottles. The chemicals or the possible GMO yeast is not labeled. How common do you think the GMO yeast is used?
I think nobody really knows because basically it was introduced in 2006. And then it was sold for a few years, but then apparently wasn't sold after a certain amount of time. But as far as that time frame, I don't think anybody really knows. You'd have to talk to the distributor of the yeast. But so wineries did use some GMO yeast from 2006 on, and so some of that, is now probably, there's probably some wine on the shelves today that probably used it, but again, for someone to find out, you would have to phone each individual winery and ask them, which yeast they use and whether or not it was GMO yeast. So from what I understand, the original GMO yeast called MLO1 was phased out partly because the Wine Institute, which is they actually wrote a statement. I don't know the details of the statement, but they basically said that at this time, genetically engineered ingredients, aren't needed, in winemaking. So after the Wine Institute sort of made that statement, I think the yeast fell out of favor. But some wineries might still have the yeast. Perhaps they're still researching or testing it. I understand now the same group that introduced it is trying to reintroduce it, possibly under a different name and marketing it in a different way than it was originally marketed. But there's a lot of information on the internet about it. There's a good article in the Napa Valley Register from 12/12/06, written by a reporter that sort of covered the topic fairly well.
You know, it's interesting, Paul, because I read an article online, and according to a Vancouver Sun story by Randy Shore, he said that ML1 is so prevalent, and this is a quote from him, if you drink red wine from the United States or Canada, there's a good chance you've tried ML01 wine already. You wouldn't know about it because of the lack of labeling.
Right, yeah. And again, it's hard to say how much of it was sold. Only the distributor, and the person that made the original batches would know. Back to why it's an important topic. When people transgenically alter organisms, it's hard to predict gene expression. Like what they found, like in a fruit fly, one gene can express like 700 different ways, depending on genetic switches that can turn this gene on and off and so on and so forth. So because of that, it's kind of, as some people say, a genetic roulette. There was an instance from some sleep medicines from the early part of the so-called bioengineered revolution. There was a compound called L-tryptophan, which was a sleep aid. It's the same kind of compound that's found in like turkey meat that makes you feel sleepy. And they used a genetically modified strain of bacteria to try to produce more of this particular compound because it was sold as a sleep medicine or aid or whatever. And it turned out that particular genetically modified bacteria was making some of the wrong compounds, and it actually disabled a number of people. So there's actually a website about the L-tryptophan disaster, which was sort of the first genetically modified disaster that most people haven't really heard about. So once again, if you're making something like a GMO yeast, and you think you know what you're doing, we don't really know enough about gene expression and all the factors that affect gene expression, to really say with any predictability that, if we design it to do this, it'll do exactly this every time. It might do something weird if the temperature is too high, or if it has too much nitrogen, or if there's so many variables that it might click on other genetic switches that will make novel proteins that humans have never ingested before, possibly. So it's a complicated area, and it's sort of this attitude where humans think they got it all figured out, and we can exactly tell genes what to do and what not to do, and it's not quite like that. When you look deeper, it's really a question of gene expression and how many variables can affect gene expression. So that's why, there are some dangers there as far as transgenically modified organisms.
And what about, is there a concern for cross-contamination with the GMO yeast?
Yeah, well, that's another issue, too. See, all these wineries that possibly use this new transgenically modified yeast, ML01, what they do after they make the wine is you press the grapes and the skins, and then you put that in compost piles outside, usually near the winery or near the vineyard. And yeast, of course, can send their material airborne, and that's how they spread, around the world. So what might be happening is you might have these transgenic yeast that, if you have it in a certain famous wine region, then that yeast could be blowing, over to the next winery or to the next vineyards. So a lot of wineries pride themselves in doing what's called indigenous or native yeast fermentations. Those are the yeasts that live out there wild, and they coat the berry, and when you pick those grapes, it'll just ferment naturally. So if you then put transgenic yeast in the mix, It kind of destroys the concept of native yeast or terroir, as it's called, or terroir is sort of a sense of place or an identity. And most people identify it with the soil type and the microbial types that are naturally found in that area, you know, especially in Europe, where you'll have like cheeses that are from a certain valley. And what they found is that, you know, the same microorganisms that are in the cheese were also found in the wheat that grew in the area, et cetera. So it kind of destroys the idea of terroir if you then have, you know, genetically modified things running loose. So it takes sort of some of the mystique and romanticism away from traditional winemaking, for sure.
I just also have a concern about that, too, because our national labeling bill, which is H.R. 1699, I've actually read this bill, and one of the exemptions in this bill is, this is an exemption. It says, a food or processed food that would be subject to this paragraph solely because it includes the use of a genetically engineered processing aid, including yeast or enzyme. So my interpretation of that is if we do have a GMO yeast in a wine, that won't have to be labeled.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like based on your reading there. And then the enzyme thing is probably related to cheeses because my understanding is there are some genetically modified enzymes that possibly are used in cheeses now. So, yeah, as the bill is currently written, it might exempt cheeses, wine, and perhaps a whole huge area because enzymes are used, you know, a lot in the food industry as well as yeast. So yeah, it would be beer and wine and liquor and things and cheeses and whatnot would have an exemption based on that, you know, if the bill passes, which is a big if.
Right, but as it's currently written, it does concern me.
Yeah.
Besides the GMO yeast that can be used, there are many chemicals that are added to wine for various reasons, and the FDA does not require winemakers to label these chemicals. Can you talk with us a little bit more about that?
Right, yeah, there is a list, and I think if you Google, if you punch in your approved wine additives, you know, and you Google that, and there'll be a list under some blogger sites and whatnot, and so people can look at the list for themselves because the list is quite extensive. As far as all the details of what's on the list, you know, we don't study it too much because we don't, you know, add all those ingredients or whatever because we make organic wine without sulfites added here at our own winery, at Fry Winery here. But yeah, apparently there's things to add if the yeasts need nutrient. There's what's called diammonium phosphate, which is basically kind of like a fertilizer for the yeast so that they have enough nutrient to grow. And typically what you find is if grapes, you know, aren't grown organically, the fruit doesn't have a lot of natural sort of vitamins and minerals and nutrient. So organic winemakers don't really have a problem with nutrient poor, you know, fermentations. So they don't have to feed their yeast all this extra stuff like diammonium phosphate. You know, we've never had a problem here at our winery with our fermentations, and we think that's because the grapes are just healthy enough that the yeast aren't starved for nutrient when they're converting sugar to alcohol. Because basically the way it works is yeast, when you make wine, you take grapes, and yeast will then grow and consume sugar. And then the byproduct is alcohol and carbon dioxide, which is, you know, fizziness that comes out of the top of the tank. So, yeah, that list is on the Internet under approved wine additives. And as people will see, you know, it's quite an extensive list. And there's descriptions on what each thing is, you know, meant to do and so on and so forth. So, yeah, there's at least 50 different things you're allowed to to add to wine during the processing. And you're correct. There's no mandatory ingredient labeling on any beer or wine or liquor, possibly because it was never considered a food, and that ingredient labeling was in Europe. Supposedly, wine, beer is actually considered just another food item, whereas in America, it wasn't regulated as a food. It was regulated as something different than food. So that's probably why ingredient labeling hasn't got to wine and beer and whatnot yet.
Well, I think many people would think twice if they saw a list of chemicals on their wine bottle.
Yeah, I think that would definitely change, you know, a lot of people's, you know, it would get people thinking and get people searching for wines that had, you know, minimal, you know, or none, you know, in it. This certainly would, you know, it's the same with the GMO thing. You know, once things had GMO labeling, you know, as about 60 other countries currently have, that definitely, you know, gives a consumer more education and more choice when they purchase things for their family, and, you know, whether it be food or wine.
So let's talk a little bit about Fry Vineyards and your project. So you are the first American organic winemaker, and also the first certified biodynamic wines in the U.S.?
Right. Yeah, so we've been making wine. The first wine we actually made here on the farm was in 1975. And then we became an official winery in 1980. We, you know, what's called a bonded winery or legal winery or whatever. But we did some sort of smaller home winemaking before that. So what we do is we make organic wine with no sulfites added. About 99.9% of all the wine out there has sulfites added. What's interesting is for most of the 8,000-year history of winemaking, sulfites were never added. It's actually more sort of a more modern industrial ingredient that really was used in sort of a measured way, you know, where you measure amounts and whatnot, for only about 100 years or so. Before that, it was used basically just to sanitize, you know, a moldy or vinegary barrel. You know, if you had a barrel sitting around empty for, you know, a few days or a month, what they found is, you know, to keep it sanitized, because, you know, they didn't have hot water or steam sterilization, what they would do is they'd burn what's called a sulfur candle in the barrel. But it looks as though that practice only really originated, the earliest we found was 1449. It was introduced into Germany basically to sanitize barrels. But then what they found is if you burn a lot of sulfur over the wine in the barrel, you know, and with enough parts per million of sulfur, it'll actually kill everything in there. So you can actually make a sweet wine, you know, it'll even keep juice sweet and not allow it to ferment. So once again, for most of the 8,000-year history, there's no real evidence it was used, but was introduced as a barrel sanitizer in 1449. And then for about 100 years, it was used, as I mentioned, as an industrial ingredient where you put in X amount, you know, to kill, you know, fermentation or whatever. But it was used in those days because a lot of wineries in those days weren't very sanitary. You know, they had old wooden, either redwood barrels or wooden barrels. So you can see where 100 years ago, it was sort of, you know, a new modern kind of method for sanitation. But now people have, you know, on-demand, you know, steam and hot water. And so what you see now is that the winemaking has become so modern and advanced that sulfites are now, you know, non-essential to modern winemaking.
But they certainly are pervasive. I even pick up organic wine, and it'll say sulfites added.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the wine you probably picked up said, you know, made from organically grown grapes.
Mm-hmm.
But if it has the USDA logo or seal that says USDA organic, you are not allowed to add sulfites to what's called USDA certified organic wine. If you add sulfites, then all you can write is, you know, made from organically grown grapes on the label.
Now, I have a question about that. So if it says made from organically grown grapes, can they, well, they can add sulfites, but can they add, other chemicals in the winemaking process?
Not that I'm aware of, you know, as far as that list of the 50 things or whatever. No, you're not allowed to add diammonium phosphate. Based on my understanding, if it says, you know, made from organically grown grapes, you can only add things that are approved by the National Organic Program. If you go to the USDA NOP website, it has a list of allowed, you know, things in food processing. And so what you'll see there is everything that's allowed and not allowed.
So sulfites would be an allowable ingredient if it said just organically grown grapes. Sulfites would be allowed, correct?
Yeah. You see, what happened was originally when they made the National Organic Standards back in, well, it started way back in 1990 is where they started to develop them, but then it didn't become law until 2000 or whatever. But what happened was there was originally when organic started, there was sort of three bad ingredients in food processing, and that was sulfite was one of them. And then the other two were sodium nitrate for meats, you know, because that breaks down your stomach and makes nitric acid or whatever it is, which can cause stomach cancer and all that. And then there's a few others, like whatever, sodium benzoate or whatever. So what happened was when they made the organic laws, and then they talked about them for 10 years, and then they were just about to make the final ruling, what they realized what some big wineries realized that were trying to market organic wine was that they weren't going to be allowed to add sulfite anymore. So there was sort of a lobbying effort by some big wineries. And what they did is at the last minute, basically, is they kind of cut a deal or whatever that said, okay, we can add sulfite to wine only. It's not allowed in any other food product. You know, like dried fruits used to have sulfites, and a lot of pickles still have sulfite, and vinegars have sulfites. So what they did is they kind of, like I said, it was kind of a lobbying effort, and they cut a deal, and they said, okay, there's going to be one exception in all of organics for the use of sulfite, and that'll be for wine. But you will not be able to use the USDA seal. But all you'll be able to say is that it was made from organically grown grapes. So that was the deal that was cut back in 2000. Again, it was a lobbying effort by some in the wine industry. And then just recently, this is about 2 years ago, there was another lobbying effort by, again, some in the wine industry where they wanted to change that original ruling. You know, they already got a special exemption back in 2000, but 2 years ago there was another lobbying effort. It's, you know, it's recorded and whatnot in the USDA Organic NOSB meetings, National Organic Standard Board meetings, and what they wanted to do is say, say, we want to use the USDA seal and add sulfites. We were involved in that, in defeating that. We spoke in, as in Wisconsin and Seattle and then Savannah, Georgia, to protect, you know, the meaning of organics, which is always, you know, chemical and preservative free. And sulfur dioxide is actually, you know, is one of the chemicals that you know, asthmatic people can be sensitive to, and so on and so forth. And it just simply doesn't belong in organics. I think everybody would agree to that. But nevertheless, a group did petition to try to allow sulfur dioxide back in organics, USDA organics, meaning where you have the seal on the, you know, on the product. So, you know, so that was a battle. That was 2 years ago, and the idea was to, you know, preserve the integrity of organics. You know, if organics is going to stand, it has to stand for something.
Right.
And what that means is, you know, no sulfur dioxide. I mean, if you start putting, if you allow it for wine, then you're going to have to then allow it for, you know, organic dried fruits, and then allow it for organic dried pickles. And pretty soon you'll see sulfur dioxide in everything, or in organics, and that's just not right. You know, organics, if organics is going to stand, it has to stand for something.
Right. And so that was defeated?
Yeah, so we defeated that, you know, ourselves here at the winery. You know, I personally had to go to Wisconsin, Seattle, and Georgia over a 2.5-year period. A big group of organic no sulfide wineries all came together, and we had to speak in front of the National Organic Standards Board to tell them that you know, organic is supposed to mean preservative and chemical free,
mm-hmm.
and sulfur dioxide just simply is not allowed, especially because it's the one ingredient that actually requires a warning label on every bottle of wine. In other words, there's a reason why every bottle of wine sold in Europe and America today has to state, you know, contains sulfites if they add sulfite, because chemically sensitive people do get a reaction to, you know, high amounts of sulfites in wine. So again, that's sort of history now, but, you know, I mean, it might happen again, because anybody can petition to add any ingredient into organics. All you have to do is go to the National Organic Standards Board. You can even petition a synthetic ingredient. You know, sulfur dioxide is considered a synthetic ingredient. Tomorrow you could go to the National Organic Standards Board and say, you know, I'd like to petition, you know, monosodium glutamate, because I think it's necessary in organics. See, the way the organic rules work is, if you search the whole galaxy and can't find any alternative ingredient, then it's allowable in organics. It sounds goofy, but that's the way it's written. So what we did is we proved that sulfur dioxide is non-essential. So the word they use is this synthetic ingredient essential to making this organic product? Okay, if someone can prove that it's essential, then you can allow a synthetic ingredient into organics. But if you can prove that it's not essential, then it's not allowed in organics. So again, it's goofy, but that's just the way they wrote the law when they made the National Organic Program.
That's interesting. So you just had to go there and prove that you can make wine and it is not essential to add sulfites.
Yeah, basically we showed, you know, the 8,000-year history. You know, we had quotes from say Strabo AD 60, you know, where Strabo said, you know, Ferengo Valley wines were excellent. They did not need to be resinated. See, they used to add tree resin to preserve wine. So they did not need to be resinated, and they would last 50 years. You know, so that's an example where they weren't adding sulfite, and they weren't adding the natural tree resins, and they were making good, sound wines that would last 50 years. So it's a myth that sulfur dioxide is necessary for winemaking. Historically, there's just no evidence for it, again, until about 1449, where it was used to basically sanitize dirty barrels.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit about biodynamics. I think that's a word that many people don't understand. Biodynamic farming and biodynamic wines. Can you just give us kind of a brief overview of what this process is?
Basically what it is, it's first you just use all the principles of organic, I mean, as sort of your base, and then the guy who sort of, you know, came up with the approach, his name was Rudolf Steiner, and, you know, he helped started the Waldorf education system and so on. But basically what it is, you basically add sort of homeopathic doses of, you know, basically composted, basically cow manure, where you keep it underground, you know, over the winter. And I think basically it sort of decomposes, and the worms probably get in there and completely, you know, compost it. And then you put, you know, very small amounts or homeopathic doses, you know, like ounces per acre. And the idea there was that it was, in the same way the homeopathy sort of, you know, will stimulate plants to do certain things, that these small amount of doses of material, you know, will stimulate the plant. You know, they found, like, if you take, like, worm castings, for instance, and sort of an emerging area of agriculture, that turns out that worms, as they digest stuff, they make all these, you know, wonderful combinations of, you know, natural biochemistry that, you know, when you give it to the plant, it really stimulates the plant and activates, you know, again, this is like it triggers certain genes to switch on and off, and can actually help the plant. So biodynamics is sort of, you know, a version of that, in the same way people are taking, you know, biodigested worm castings and using them to, you know, enhance the, some people use the word to wake up, you know, the soil, or to, you know, to wake the plant up. And more and more you're finding more evidence, you know, of plants having those abilities. You know, plants can chemically communicate with each other. You know, when one is getting chewed on by caterpillars, it actually sends a chemical to the plants downwind, and it makes those plants start making more bitter compounds, so that their leaves become more bitter, so that when the caterpillars then get to the next plant, they're not going to want to eat that plant as much. So there's this whole big, you know, interconnected web and hierarchies and whatnot, you know, from the soil all the way up into the plant, all the way up into, you know, some say, you know, a lot of people, a lot of old farmers believe that the moon affects, you know, germination of seeds and so on. Some people go a little farther and say, okay, well, Venus and Mars also, you know, perhaps affects the bacteria that are in the soil and so on. And there seems to be, as far as the moon goes, there seems to be evidence, you know, the moon does affect, you know, plant growth and whatnot. So it's kind of an open-ended thing, where I think what it was is there's been, like, I think Steiner sort of borrowed, you know, on, you know, 5 or 10,000 years of kind of peasant knowledge, where, you know, peasants would always sort of do things by the stars and where the moon was, you know, when to plant, when to do this and that. So I think with modern agriculture, some of those ideas were sort of getting lost. And I think Steiner was trying to reintroduce some of the ancient ideas and methods. And a lot of these ideas aren't that new. You know, if you read the Roman writings on agriculture, and I've read quite a bit of it, a lot of what the Romans were doing, was similar to some of the stuff you see in biodynamics. And I think biodynamics is only a starting point. In other words, biodynamics is sort of one of the stepping stones toward a new natural agriculture. It's not the first or the last word, but it's made its contribution. It was useful in inspiring the modern day organic movement. Some people call it sort of the earliest organic movement because it was sort of a response to the introduction of chemical farming, because they had just introduced, synthetic nitrogen a few years before Steiner gave his lectures. And so once again, biodynamics is one approach and one of the stepping stones, I think, towards what you'll see in the future. Like 10,000 years from now, you'll see a sort of a new natural agriculture that'll be a combination of all the different, methods, from permaculture to biointensive farming to, the whole mix. Now, this wouldn't include transgenic modification, of course. We're talking about, natural farming, not synthetic petrochemical transgenic farming.
Right. So the biodynamic process just sounds like it makes the soil more nutrient dense.
Yeah, I think that's the idea. Is that, again, to use homeopathic doses of natural material to try to enhance and enliven and make the soil more alive.
That's great. And so some of your wines are biodynamic certified.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and then you also fermented on its natural yeast, which is traditional and so on.
Hmm. And your website, you want to give your website to our listeners so they can go check out all your wine and all your methods?
Yeah, so the website is freywine.com. It's freywine.com.
And it's a great website. I've been on it several times, and there's a lot of information on there.
Yeah, my brother actually built the website, so it's a homegrown website too.
Great. Well, I want to. This may be off subject a little bit from wine, but maybe not. I recently interviewed Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is a leading expert on the effects of nuclear power and radiation. And I understand you have some knowledge in this field and have actually given talks or presentations on the effects of nuclear power on agriculture. You want to share a little bit about that with our listeners?
Yeah. So we have been involved and we worked with some of the folks to help shut down the San Onofre nuclear plant down in Los Angeles. I recently gave a talk down there, right before it was shut down, and gave a slideshow on basically what it would mean for, agriculture and the LA Basin if, in fact, it did melt down and the fuel pools burns. See, most people don't realize it, but if a nuclear power plant has trouble, it's not just the meltdown that's your concern. The bigger concern is actually if the fuel pools catch fire. That can actually release, depending on the size of the fuel pool, that can be 20 to 40 times worse than the actual meltdown itself. So the presentation I gave basically talked about that, and we had maps and so on. So what this, of course, would mean for agriculture, for California, is it turns out that Diablo Canyon, which is the only it's the single operating nuclear plant now in California. It's the last one. Three have already been shut down, the one in Humboldt Bay near Eureka, the one at Rancho Seco, which almost melted down, which is right south of Sacramento, and then you had San Onofre, which had radiation leaks up until about a year ago. That's now shut down. But the only remaining one is what's called Diablo Canyon. That's situated on the coast right to the west of San Luis Obispo, and more, of course, what's more frightening about that one, of course, is that it's right to the west of one of the most famous agricultural areas on the planet, which is the California's Central Valley, which includes the San Joaquin Valley and the Sacramento Valley. You know, they're all together there. So if in a worst case scenario you had, you know, single or double meltdown of Diablo Canyon, the fuel pools could then possibly catch fire because you can't work around a place that's melting down. So if it all burned, that could be up to 40 times the amount of a single meltdown, because you have about 1,000 to 1,500 tons of spent fuel, as it's called, in the fuel pools. And what's bad about its location is that it's basically upwind from the Central Valley. The wind in California, as most people know, blows from the coast, and then inland, it's sucked inland as, you know, as the Central Valley warms up in the day, like during the summer, it'll suck air into the valley. So what that could mean for California, if you had a worst case meltdowns and fuel pool fire at Diablo Canyon, in the most severe worst case, the Central Valley could become radioactively contaminated for generations. And what would happen is it ends up in the food, because it turns out radioactive cesium mimics potassium. In other words, it behaves like potassium on the periodic table. So any plant that takes up potassium would then take up the radioactive cesium. And then when you ingest that food, any place in your body that uses potassium, you know, then cesium would take the place, and then it would build up in different organs and whatnot. So one way to look at it, if you had special goggles, like Superman goggles or whatever, after a radioactive meltdown and fuel pool fire, all the fallout would fall onto the land. And what you would see, and this is what they see in Japan now, is that you'll have, there'll be like, you know, algae growing by a drain, you know, in a town. And that particular algae loves potassium or whatever. So what it does is it super concentrates the cesium like 10,000 times to where it's so radioactive you wouldn't even want a kid to be around it. And then mushrooms also super concentrate potassium, but after a nuclear meltdown, it would super concentrate the cesium. So even, you know, after Chernobyl, which was in 86, 25 or more years ago, after Chernobyl melted down in Germany today, you know, every pig that's caught has to be tested because the pigs eat mushrooms, which are still concentrating the cesium out in the forest. So, again, if you had special goggles and you looked, you know, say in the Central Valley after a meltdown of fuel pool fire, you'd see concentrations like what they found in Japan was the pollen that comes off the cedar trees had super concentrations of the cesium. So now instead of just having allergy season, you have radioactive allergy season, because you have radioactive pollen that's now blowing in the wind. So again, what you'd see is, if you had these special goggles, you'd see glowing concentrations of different materials in different parts or different organs of animals and plants. And depending on what the radioactive compound was, it would be located in a different place in the plant or in the person. So it's just way too dangerous to have. And again, Diablo Canyon is only 300 paces from a newly discovered earthquake fault called the Shoreline Fault. It was only discovered in 2008. And then there's a minor fault called the Diablo Cove Fault that, believe it or not, goes right under Reactor 1 and probably right through Fuel Pool 1. So it's just really a disaster waiting to happen, and there's a big effort now to try to shut the last remaining nuclear plant in California called Diablo Canyon.
And how's that progressing?
Well, slowly. You know, San Onofre took a while, but there was a lot of good people working on it, and I mean, one way to look at it is if you tried to build Diablo Canyon today, you simply would not be able to build it because there's multiple faults. There's the major fault, the Hasri fault, only a couple miles offshore. Then you have the newly discovered shoreline fault, which is, again, 300 paces from the water intake of the plant. And then you have the minor fault, which goes right under the plant. You would not be able to build that today. You simply could not approve it. But since it's already there and the billions have been spent, what they're doing is just sort of using every kind of legal means to keep the thing open, you know, but you know, the thing should be shut down, and they're literally going to just try to keep it running, you know, into the ground, basically. They're trying to get extensions for all these nuclear plants, even though they're only made to last, you know, 20 to 40 years. So it's definitely, as far as I can see, it's the biggest threat to California right now, is its remaining nuclear plant. And, of course, the fuel pool at San Onofre, which is going to take years to just clean up that fuel pool. There's no place to store the waste, so they just do what's called dry cask storage. And, you know, dry cask storage only lasts about 60 years. And but a terrorist could also, you know, mess with dry cask storage. So the nuclear will never be safe because you have, you know, crazy people that, you know, always want to mess things up.
Now, were you concerned with the radiation fallout from Fukushima on the West Coast?
Yeah, we actually had Geiger counters here, you know, the days after it. We had two Geiger counters. We didn't see any readings, at least from our Geiger counters, that we could notice. But, you know, there was some readings that they found, you know, in milk in Oregon and so on.
Yes.
And, you know, and I think I read a Japanese article that they said that, you know, there was some pistachios from California that had small amounts of something. So, it, you know, it definitely, you know, came to California. It sounds like different areas got hit differently, but nobody, the government, you know, no one really did any proper research on it. It's an area that's important and it should be studied.
Right. And when I was speaking with Dr. Caldicott, one thing she's concerned about is reactor 4 at Fukushima, because she said if that goes down, she will evacuate. She lives in Australia. She will evacuate her family from Boston, because she said that will affect the whole northern hemisphere.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And all reactor 4 is, that's only a fuel pool. That's not even, because the reactor wasn't even loaded there. So what she was talking about there is the fuel pool. And what that is, that's, you know, 15 or 20 years of spent fuel plus the new fuel that they were about to put into reactor 4. So, yeah, if any fuel pool is burning anywhere, you definitely, you know, don't want to be downwind, because it's, like we said, it's up to 20 to 40 to 60 times, you know, a single meltdown, because it's multiple years of reactor cores that are actually hotter than the original fuel that they put in, hotter meaning more radioactive. So yeah, as far as nuclear goes, they really just all need to be shut down, and all you can do is just work at a local level. Like, you know, we live in California, so we're helping shut down the ones in California. You know, it's hard for us to shut the ones down in Japan. The Japanese are doing a good job at that. And, you know, depending on what state you're in, if you're back east, I'm working with some doctors in Washington. It's called Physicians for Social Responsibility. And
right. I know about that group.
Yeah, so they're up there in Washington, and they emailed me to help make some plume maps, you know, that would show, you know, how big the fallout would be in Washington based on the Chernobyl. We use Chernobyl as a base reference because Chernobyl was the only one that was ever really measured in detail. Fukushima wasn't really measured in detail because most of it went out into the ocean and over to the United States. Whereas Chernobyl was. So what we do is we take the Chernobyl fallout pattern and we superimposed that over a map of Washington. And this is what I did for my talk down in Southern California, is superimpose it over L.A. And it shows you, you know, okay, if Chernobyl happened here, this is the amount of radiation and fallout you would get. But then we take it a step further, and you say, okay, but a fuel pool fire is 20 times to 40 times worse than a meltdown, depending on how much is stored in the fuel pool. So then what you do is you say, take that Chernobyl pattern and multiply it 40 times, and then you see the seriousness of the situation for L.A. or for Diablo Canyon or the Central Valley or for the people up in Washington. So it's sort of beyond serious. It's like there's no way to describe. There's no known economic modeling that takes into account what a total fuel pool burn would do for the state of California. It would be like 10 times beyond, you know, its gross domestic, you know, product, and it would affect people for generations. It's so beyond anything. It's just beyond comprehension what it would do. That's why, just in a nutshell, all you can say is any nuclear plant in your area, do as much as you can to shut that thing down, because it would devastate the tourism industry. It would devastate the agricultural industry. It would make people's homes and backyards radioactive for generations. The whole thing is just beyond comprehension. It's just something you can't really put into words.
Right. One thing that Dr. Caldicott said was it's just a catastrophe waiting to happen and nobody's talking about it. And when I think you and I know when she says nobody, it's like mainstream media is not talking about it.
Yeah, that's definitely correct, and it's something that needs to change. The more people can talk about it and understand it, it's an educational process, and once people are educated, it's clear to them that you just can't have something like that in your backyard or your county or your state. And it's slowly moving in that direction. You know, Germany is going to shut down all their nukes by 2022. Italy voted to not allow them. Switzerland's phasing theirs out. Belgium is trying to phase theirs out by 2020-something. So in each country now, people are understanding that it's not worth it. I mean, there was a study in France that if the fuel pools burned, you can look it up on the internet, they store most of their fuel in this place called, you know, I don't speak French, but it's called like Le Hague or something. And just a simple mathematical analysis of if a crazy person or a terrorist or just a malfunction at the place, if that thing burned, it would pretty much be the end of France. I mean, for generations, this is a country that has a 2,000-year-old proud history and, you know, built up from, you know, and it would basically bring a country to its knees, basically, and it would, you know, tourism would be finished. The food products they make would be finished.
Well, one thing that on the food products, Dr. Caldicott also said that she believes, and there's been studies, that 40% of the food in Europe is contaminated with radiation already.
Yeah, and that's from both Chernobyl and the early atomic bomb testing.
See, right.
What's interesting is that's why atomic bomb testing was stopped, because they're finding strontium in babies' teeth and so on and so forth. So that was well known. So the question is, how come they're not using the same standards that said, okay, let's stop nuclear testing because we can see this contamination? That should also apply to nuclear power plants. And nuclear power plants simply are not safe enough. Basically, there's a meltdown about every 10 years when you look at it historically. And this includes research reactors plus, you know, commercial reactors. So about every 10 years, you have a meltdown. And, you know, you simply can't go along, you know, living this way, you know, on this planet. So the goal now is to shut down the 440 nuclear plants worldwide, you know, basically as soon as you can. Again, it's going to have to happen at a local level. And that's all you can do is just, you know, work locally in your own backyard, which in our case, that's California.
Right. Well, you certainly are a busy man between winemaking and your activism to shut down the nuclear plant.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people working on it. And like I said, it's, little baby steps, just bit by bit. You know, we just have to make this a better planet. And, you know, people have the intelligence to make it happen. And they're doing it slowly. You know, it'll take some time.
Yeah. Well, we applaud you for your activism in this way, and education is the key. So thank you, Paul, for being a guest on our show today. I certainly learned a lot, and I hope our listeners did too. And I now understand more of the benefits of drinking biodynamic and organic wines. And once again, the website is frywine.com. That's F-R-E-Y wine.com. Check it out. And thanks again for listening. We'll be back next week with another great show.